Dinner that night was in a private room at a place called 18, a cool, chic new restaurant lounge in downtown Ottawa. The producers put me and Dean next to each other at the long banquet table. During dinner, the director asked from across the table if we were getting along. Dean replied, "We're getting along famously." No question, we were hitting it off. We had everything in common. At this time, it wasn't because I was trying to be whomever he wanted me to be. I was, I realized, completely myself around him. I wasn't afraid to be obnoxious or crass. I could be funny, and he responded. I was pretty sure he thought I was charming and hilarious. He told me I was tragically cute, and I thought that was adorable. Then I noticed that he had a wedding ring on. When someone asked, he pulled out photos of his children. And, oh yeah, I had a husband too. It was fun to flirt, but I knew nothing would happen. It was a non-issue. But Dean and I went to a bar after dinner, and we spent that night together at the Cartier place. My publicist would want me to say what all celebrities say when they hook up on the set of movies. We were just friends at first. A relationship developed over time. We didn't get together until we'd both left our spouses, but that's not true. Dean and I spent the first night we met together. But hear me out. Before that night, I had never cheated on Charlie. I'd worked with numerous attractive actors in the course of our relationship. I had men hit on me. There were plenty of opportunities with guys who were interesting and great. But I was married. It never occurred to me to do such a thing to my husband. I wasn't in that mode. I didn't want to hurt him. This was totally out of character. It was a testament to how powerful my connection with Dean was. Tellingly, the following day when I woke up next to Dean, I had no regrets. Something was really wrong with my marriage. Not only because I slept with this guy, although that certainly wasn't a positive sign 1 year into a marriage, but because I didn't regret it. It was Friday morning. Charlie was arriving that night. It was a 4-week shoot, and I had come straight from 2 weeks in New York. That meant I was going to be away from LA for a total of 6 weeks. Without my dogs. How could I leave Mimi and Ferris for so long? Charlie had gone home after our New York trip. Now with my then assistant and now close friend, Marcel, he was flying them to Ottawa so they could be with me. I didn't want Charlie to come. I didn't want the dogs to come. Actually, I did want the dogs to come. I really missed the dogs. But my relationship with them was much less complicated. Mostly, I spent all day feeling like a kid in high school, wondering if Dean was going to call me. That night, when I got home from work, there was a voicemail from Dean. He called me T, like lots of my friends. That felt right. But he called himself Dino, which seemed like more of a buddy nickname. Did he actually like me? Or was it an obligatory phone call? When Charlie arrived late that night, I was still wide awake, wired from the drama, but I pretended to be asleep. The next morning, I had an early call. Charlie stirred as I was leaving and told me he'd come meet me for lunch. The movie was being shot near a high school, so lunch was served in the school's cafeteria. Charlie, Marcel, the dogs, and I sat at one of the long lunch tables. Then, out of the corner of my eye, I caught someone looking over at me. It was Dean, sitting with the director, Chris. It was his day off, but he'd come for lunch. We were in a high school cafeteria, so what did I do? I pretended I didn't see him. I pretended I was just scanning the room. I let my eyes float right past him. Hello, seventh grade. After lunch, Charlie, Marcel, and I went outside and were standing around talking. Soon, Dean walked out, and I introduced him to Charlie. That was the weirdest experience of my entire life. Dean, I'd only known for a day. I felt like I was in love with him, and I doubted that was possible. Charlie was my husband, but I doubted that love too. And there I was, introducing the two of them, as if there were no conflict or doubt. Charlie stayed for the weekend. Nothing was discussed. I knew my marriage was over, but it wouldn't be right to just dump that on him. And we all know I wasn't brave enough anyway. I just wanted to get through the weekend without talking. Luckily, I was working every day. Afterward, we go to dinner with Marcel. We didn't have sex. Our sex life had waned anyway, to say the least, and I wasn't about to resuscitate it. On set with Dean, I was nervous, confused, and suddenly shy. I didn't know him. I didn't know if he hooked up with all his co-stars. On the set, the girls liked him, and I could see that he liked the attention he got from the ladies. I figured he probably isn't happy at home. Maybe whenever he does a movie, he finds someone to sleep with. I'm just another girl in a long line of conquests. I kept asking myself, if that's all it was, just a hookup, then do you have regrets? But I still didn't. It had been magical. The night Charlie left, Monday, Dean asked me to get a drink. I invited Marcel along, and the three of us had a great time. We all came back to the hotel, and Marcel went to bed. Dean and I were talking in the living room of my not-so-fab suite. I fished for whether this was his M.O., saying, "You're probably just going to flirt with girls the whole time." Flirt was my euphemism for hookup. He asked, "Is that what you think? I just do this all the time?" I said, "Yeah, maybe." He said, "Well, I don't." He, like me, had never done it before. Even if he wasn't a philanderer, he was married and he had a family. I didn't want to be naive. Nonetheless, from that day forward, we were inseparable. I'd never had a relationship develop so quickly. There were no uncomfortable first stages of dating. It felt like we'd been together our whole lives. Dean and I hid our relationship from the cast and crew. I'd just learned how to text on my BlackBerry, and I taught Dean how to use his cell to respond. Texting was the medium of our early love notes. He was writing me poems in between takes, and nobody on set knew. Only 12 days had passed when we were out to dinner with the producers and Marcel. Dean was across the table from me. Everything seemed fine when I glanced down at my BlackBerry. Dean had texted me, "I'm in big trouble." I looked up at Dean. He was staring at me, but gave no indication that something was wrong. Did someone find out? A crew member? His wife? Much as I was dying to know, I didn't want to pull out my BlackBerry and give us away. Later that night, I finally asked him, "Why are you in big trouble?" He said, "Because I'm in love with you." I said, "I love you too." It hit home. We'd been living in our own reality where we were together and we were meant to be together. We'd put the world beyond on hold. Eventually, I ended up telling my friends what was going on. By text. That's pretty much how I communicate. In the beginning of the filming, I called Charlie every night, but now I called him less and less. I'd email him from Dean's room to say it was late and I was going to bed. Dean and I had talked about our marriages and shared how and why they weren't working. I told him everything I've told you about how I wasn't myself with Charlie and how I worked so hard to convince myself it was right because I'd made so many bad choices in the past. As for Dean, his past isn't mine to tell. All I'll say is that he was unhappy in his marriage, but he loved his children deeply. Ottawa wouldn't go on forever. In fact, Ottawa would only last 14 more days. And then what? What were we going to do? Dean and I had our first talk about what would happen when we went home. He wanted to be with me and to spend the rest of his life with me, but because of certain circumstances with his family, he thought we should wait 6 months. His reasons, which I won't discuss, made sense to me. But 6 months was going to be hard. I kept asking myself, how do I know? How do I know we'll be together? I didn't want to be played for a fool. Saturday night in our hotel room, we were drunk and being silly. I told him that when I was little, our neighbor in Malibu was Lloyd Bridges. I used to play with his grandson, Beau Bridges' son Jordan, on the beach. When I was maybe 4 years old, we pretended we were getting married. We built our wedding cake out of sand, and he made me a wedding ring out of string. I knew it was a silly childhood dream, but I told Dean I'd take anything as a sign that this was real, we were committed. I said, "I just wish I had a promise ring, a string, anything around my finger so I could look down and know that it was all going to work out one day." As if a ring would make a difference. Wasn't I that foolish girl having the affair with a married man? After we talked about a promise ring and parting ways for 6 months, Dean fell asleep. I went out to the living room of our suite and sat there for an hour, crying quietly. I was crying because I'd met the right person, for the first, the only time in my life. And even though I knew I had to leave Charlie, Dean would go back home to his family and realize he belonged there. My hours on the movie kept me on the set later than Dean. The plan was for Dean to bring dinner over to my penthouse. When he appeared, he told me that he had something for me. It was my unengagement ring, the promise ring I'd asked for. It was only made out of yarn, but he'd worked hard on it. There was a braided black linen wool string, like the kind of string you'd use for gift wrapping, and he'd sewn pink thread, my favorite color, through to accent it. Remember, this is a guy who knows a fabulous bag when he sees one. Where he tied the ends together, he frayed them out into a spray to look like a ring top. Dean told me that this was my promise ring, the symbol that he was going to marry me one day. When I saw the string ring, I started crying so hard, and I thought about how when Charlie and I got engaged, he'd put together such an elaborate, romantic night, and it didn't affect me this powerfully. Our work on the movie was done, but we weren't leaving for 2 days, so I had a Hawaiian-themed wrap party in my penthouse in Rooftop Digs. During the party, I was dancing, and the ring that Dean made for me flew off. It was dark out. The entire rooftop was covered in little beige rocks. It was like looking for a needle in a haystack. I was devastated. My engagement ring. I lost my engagement ring. The next morning, I was obsessed with finding my string ring before we flew home. It had been so meaningful to me that I was afraid losing it was equally meaningful. Maybe Dean and I weren't meant to be. We searched until we were in danger of missing our flight. I headed inside to finish packing. Half an hour later, Dean came in. He had the ring. He put it on me. Maybe it was meant to be after all. The flight home was our last 5 hours together. Dean and I sat next to each other. It started off happy. Dean pulled out our airplane sick bags, and we took turns writing down all the things we wanted to do together in life. I wrote, "I want to go wine tasting in Napa and eat at French Laundry with you." He wrote, "I want to get a place at a beach in California with you." I wrote, "I want to learn Spanish with you." He wrote, "I want to travel the world with you." I wrote, "I want us to go to Maui together." He wrote, "I want to open a bar with you." I wrote, "We promise never to be apart for more than 3 days." He wrote, "I want us to keep in touch with our Ottawa friends." I wrote, "To love each other madly." He wrote, "To love our children madly." As the plane descended, so did reality. I started crying, again. Love was sure making me cry a lot. Dean said, "You have to believe. We're going to be happy and be together and have lots of children together." I knew we had some painful confrontations between here and there. Breaking news. Charlie wanted to come pick me up at the airport, but I wanted to be able to say goodbye to Dean. So I lied to Charlie and told him I was coming home a day later. When you've already broken your wedding vows, lying about a flight arrival, not such a big deal. My relationship with Charlie was already strained. I'd stopped calling and emailing regularly. When Dean and I landed, each of us had a car waiting. Our goodbye was short. We hugged and said we loved each other. He and his family were heading to Palm Springs the next day for a week-long family vacation with another couple. He said, "I promise I'll text you. I'll call you when I can." We parted. Charlie was in his office on the computer when I came in a day earlier than he expected me. Surprise! I gave him a hug. Then I told him I had a headache from the flight. I often get migraines when I fly. And went straight to bed. Exhaustion. Avoidance. The two had completely blended in my head. When I woke up, all I knew was that I had to get out of the house. I met up with Jenny and Moran at the W Hotel in Westwood. Out on the patio, I told them the entire story, down to the pink thread and the string ring. Neither of them seemed particularly surprised that my marriage had bombed in such short order. The next day, I told my other two best friends, Amy and Sarah. Jenny and Moran joined us for a summit on the patio of the Four Seasons. Again, no one was surprised. But they were wary of the fact that Dean was married with kids and that I was telling them we wanted to get married as soon as our divorces were final. My friends were suspicious and wanted to meet him. I wanted them to meet him too, but all I could do was show them photos of Dean and his kids. They were a part of him, and I loved them for that before I ever met them. But Jenny claims that even as I told them how much I loved him, I kept saying, "I know he's not going to leave his wife. I know this isn't going to work out." 3 days passed, during which I avoided Charlie as much as possible, staying out all day shopping with Jenny and Moran, then pleading exhaustion and forcing myself to crash at 9 p.m. Not an easy feat for a night owl. Dean was texting and leaving me messages, reassuring me whenever he got a free moment. Nothing had changed. He was still in love with me. He felt as miserable and duplicitous as I did. Then, in one instant, everything changed. Moran and I were hanging out, and my phone rang. It was Dean. He said, "I left her. I just left her. I'm on my way back from Palm Springs." I'd been expecting to live this lie for 6 months. It had only been 3 days, and here was Dean saying, "I have to see you. Can you meet me?" Of course. Of course I wanted to see him right away. But my head was spinning. Oh my God, was this really happening? Oh my God, I had to leave Charlie. I was dreading the confrontation with Charlie. I wanted it to be over with. Through the dizzy rush of hope and dread, I heard Dean on the other end of the line saying, "Where are you going to be?" I'm not one for a tete-a-tete. I do better surrounded by my faithful support team. Besides, I needed my friends to meet Dean. No part of me thought I was making another mistake, but I wanted them to meet him, to see us, and to, well, to give me their blessing. So I told Dean to meet me and Moran on the patio of the Chateau Marmont on the Sunset Strip. I seemed to conduct all my powwows on the patios of hotel bars. I called Amy and Marcel, whom Dean knew well from Ottawa, to join us. As soon as I saw Dean, the fear drained right out of me. It all came rushing back. This was my love. He'd come for me. That imaginary prince I'd given up on years ago. My friends all felt completely comfortable with him. It seemed like a natural fit, but they were worried about how it would all shake down, and so was I. That night, Dean and I stayed in a room at the chateau. To my relief, our connection wasn't geographically confined to Ottawa. It was magical. At some point, I called Charlie and told him I wasn't coming home that night, making up something about staying over at my friend Sarah's. Charlie said it was fine, but he said, "Tomorrow night, we're having sex. It's important for our relationship." That said it all to me. Our marriage was mechanical. Whether he knew it, we were both just going through the motions. The next morning, Dean spoke on the phone with the husband of the couple his family had been vacationing with in Palm Springs. By now, I knew what had gone down in Palm Springs. His wife had noticed that he was acting distant. She started asking questions, and he told her the truth. She asked him to leave. Now on the phone, Dean was apologizing to his friend for ruining their vacation. He asked how his family was doing. Whatever was said, when Dean got off the phone, he started to cry. He said, "I don't know what to do. I don't want to lose my kids." I couldn't bear to see him like that. I said, "I can't do this. I can't come between you and your children. Maybe you need to be with your family, even if you're not in a happy marriage." But he said, "No, we're in love. I have to find a way to work this out." I didn't want anyone to be hurt. Not Dean's family, not Charlie. But Dean and I were meant to be together. That night, my friends had put together a welcome home get-together for me on the patio, always the patio, of the Crescent Hotel in Beverly Hills. Before it started, I met up with Dean at the nearby L'Hermitage Hotel for a drink. I was dreading the encounter with Charlie so much that I was 45 minutes late. When I finally forced myself to go, the party wasn't as torturous as I'd anticipated. It was easy to avoid my husband. We weren't the kind of couple who stayed close together when we were socializing, particularly with my friends. During the party, in the hotel bathroom, I told some of my other friends what was going on, that I was going to leave Charlie. The more people I told, the more I noticed the same response. Nobody seemed shocked. but I still hadn't told the person who was least likely to have that response. That weighed on me at every moment. If anything was clear to me, it was that I couldn't have sex with Charlie. The fact of my affair was bad enough, but to physically go back and forth between two men seemed like it would compound the offense. It would be a disservice to Charlie, and significantly, it felt like cheating on Dean. I absolutely couldn't do it. As the night progressed, I got increasingly nervous. So when my friend Garen texted me from the other end of the long table to say, "We're going to Foo Bar. Wanna go?" the answer was easy. I texted back, "I'm in." Foo Bar was a gay bar where I knew for sure I'd be completely safe from heterosexual wifely duties. I didn't know it, but down at the opposite end of the table, Charlie was reading over Garen's shoulder. He came up to me and said, "It's getting late. Time to go home. I want to go home with my wife." I said I didn't want to go. We went back and forth like that a little, and then subconsciously I kind of realized that if Charlie and I fought, I wouldn't have to go home with him. I screamed across the patio, "I'm going to Foo Bar!" The table got quiet. There was an uncomfortable pause. Then Charlie jokingly said, "If you go to Foo Bar, our marriage is over." And suddenly, we were closer to the truth than I'd anticipated. In a light, tipsy way, I said, "Well, I want to go out with my gays. I'm going to Foo Bar." That was my code for, "I wish everything had happened differently, and I've gone about this wrong, and I'm sorry, but the truth is that our marriage is over." Apparently, Charlie didn't know the code. He said, "Can we talk about this in private?" Charlie drew me aside into the tiny lobby of the hotel. He said, "What are you doing? What is wrong with you? You've been distant since you've been home. I want to be with my wife." As we all know, this was a completely reasonable line of questioning. But I was doing what guilty parties do best, picking a fight. This was the path toward not going home, and I wasn't about to change directions. I said, "I just got home. I want to be with my friends, and you're trying to control me and tell me when we're leaving." We hadn't fought much in our relationship. I hadn't expressed myself. Now I was on a roll. "You know," I said, "maybe we just don't have that much in common. Maybe we want different things. Maybe we're at different points in our lives." It was the exact same fight we'd had on my birthday right before our wedding. But this time, there was no upcoming wedding volunteering itself as a rug to sweep the fight under. Charlie said, "Maybe we are too different." Now I was getting somewhere. Maybe when it came down to it, he'd understand. I said, "This makes me not want to go home with you. I told Charlie I wasn't going to Foo Bar, but that I was going to crash at our friends Suzanne and Marcel's house." I walked out. Dean picked me up from Suzanne and Marcel's, and we went to a hotel called the Farmer's Daughter that night. It was the second in what would be a series of nights in random hotels. When we woke up the next morning, I said, "I'm not going back home. I'm not going back." At some point in those first crazy homeless days, I got in touch with my therapist. I needed to talk to Charlie to tell him I wanted to separate, and I just couldn't do it. She suggested that Charlie and I meet and talk in her office. She wouldn't take sides. She'd just be a mediator and help me tell him. It sounded like my best option. Even though my friends admitted that they never thought Charlie was my match, they weren't exactly gung-ho on the current situation. Moran called. He said that Charlie had called and that he had no idea what was going on. It wasn't right. Moran said I had to call him. I couldn't summon the courage. So Jenny helped me compose an email to Charlie saying that I was sorry for the way I'd behaved at the Crescent Hotel. I wrote that I was out of line, but that it came from something real. I told him we needed to talk, but that I didn't want to come home. I asked him to meet me Monday morning at my therapist's office. In the email, I said, "Please know that I love you." I hesitated to write it. I didn't want to give him false hope, but I wasn't heartless. I did love him. I just wasn't in love with him. At any rate, it was an email, hardly the best way to communicate. The end was in place. On Monday morning, my friend Amy showed up to drive me to the appointment. I managed to haul myself into the car, but it was the longest drive ever. My heart was pounding. I didn't want to go. I couldn't do it. I was sure I couldn't do it. And yet, there I was, waiting in the therapist's office when Charlie came in. He saw me and started to cry. He said, "I'm not going to let you get rid of me. I love you." We hugged and sat down. With some prodding from the therapist, I started talking. I focused on why I was leaving Charlie, not on Dean. I told him that I wasn't in love with him. I told him that I'd never been in love with him. I loved him, and he'd been a friend to me. But I married him because he was a great guy, a nice guy, a guy who took care of me. Finding someone who loved me seemed like enough. I thought you either were in love or you loved each other, but I didn't realize they could coexist. Charlie didn't want to hear it or believe it. He kept saying, "You're happy. Where's this all coming from? We have a perfect relationship." I pushed onward. I explained that I wasn't sexually attracted to him, that I wasn't happy in the marriage, that it wasn't right for me. It wasn't sinking in. Charlie could be blind to things he didn't want to see. He resisted hearing what I was saying. Finally, the therapist stepped in. She's trying to separate. She's saying she doesn't want to be in this marriage. Then she went on to say, "Tori is saying she isn't in love with you. She doesn't have that weak-in-the-knees feeling." Charlie said, "Movie romance doesn't exist. It's a fairy tale. It isn't real. We're happy." Then he turned to me. "Is this about someone else? Did you cheat on me?" I said yes. He said, "It was with Dean, wasn't it?" I said yes. He said, "I should have known." I made sure to tell him that I'd felt this way throughout the whole relationship. I wasn't leaving him because of the affair. I kept saying, "I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to hurt you. I didn't mean for this to happen." And that was pretty much it. We agreed to talk again. He left angry and hurt, and I felt sorry and sad. When a marriage fails, the story of the relationship changes. Charlie made me happy. He was good to me. He made me feel safe. He shared his family with me. We supported each other. Something about it did work for a while. I wasn't miserable, but it wasn't right. I didn't know what right felt like until I met Dean. There would be a divorce, and there would be press, but it was over. It needed to end, but it could have happened in a nicer way. I wish I'd been able to communicate with Charlie from the beginning of our relationship, and I should have handled things differently at the end. He's a sensitive, kind person. I know he would have listened. If I'd let our differences reveal themselves earlier, well, we might never have gotten married. Safe at last. Dean and I stayed at Casa Del Mar for a week, but it was getting expensive. We rented a furnished apartment in a building called the Marlowe in Hancock Park. The Marlowe was not what I was used to. It was a regular apartment building. I felt like I was living in Melrose Place. And you know your sense of reality is whacked when the best image you have of normal life is a television drama that your father invented. Our apartment was a 1,000-square-foot two-bedroom. The front door opened into the kitchen. It was modest in size, but comfortably furnished. I had a little bag of clothes I'd bought at Urban Outfitters, plus a single suitcase of stuff that Marcel had brought over from my apartment. Soon, we would pick up the dogs. That was it. I couldn't think of anything else I needed. My life was suddenly so simple, so small, so happy. To that point, I was the happiest I'd ever been. Nonetheless, there was an outside world that refused to disappear. My agent and manager wanted me to take a meeting. Soon enough, they knew, the press would be onto the story and there would be tabloid covers with photos of us torn in half saying split. Seriously, can't they think of any other eye-catching breakup image? Ultimately, my publicist put out a statement I wasn't totally happy with. It was a lie, or, at very best, a manipulation of the truth. She wrote that Charlie and I split up, true, that we had been living separate lives since the beginning of August, sort of since I'd gone to Ottawa on August 3rd, and that we had decided to separate. We. Definitely not true. My publicist put the statement out on the AP wire. The next day, it was picked up everywhere. Right before the press release went out, I emailed my mother saying, "I need to talk to you about something that's happened in my life. I want you to be aware of it before you hear about it. Please let me know a good time to call you." My mother emailed back saying, "Try me tomorrow. Know that I love you, and I'm always here for you." I tried her the next day, and we started playing phone tag. I finally reached my father the afternoon the news broke. He said, "Don't worry. I love you. Do whatever you need to do that's right for you." He'd probably already heard the news that morning, but at least we got to talk about it a little. A few days passed, and I gave up on reaching my mother. But then right after we'd announced the separation, her 60th birthday rolled around. There was a big party for her at Il Cielo in Beverly Hills. I couldn't imagine walking into a party full of all my mother's friends who'd just been at my wedding. If I went and put on a happy face, people would say I was heartless. If I acted serious and shamed, they'd say I was self-absorbed. So I just didn't go. I felt terrible for missing a milestone birthday. So, in the spirit of my parents' bigger is better birthday approach, I ordered a massive arrangement of flowers to be delivered to her at the party. It was the largest, most elaborate flower arrangement I've ever seen. On the card, I said how sorry I was that I couldn't be there, and I backed it up with a longer email to my mom explaining that I was filming, but also that it was a difficult time to go to a public event. My mother sent an email thanking me for the flowers. It said that the party was wonderful. She wrote, "It was a great night. Everyone who cares about me came out to celebrate my birthday." Message received, loud and clear. Not long after that, I got an email from my mother's business manager saying something like, "Your mother feels it is a good time investment-wise to put the condo up for sale. You have until March to find a new residence." Maybe she was angry to hear that I'd let Charlie stay in her apartment. Maybe it was the realization that So Notorious was going forward without her approval. Who knows? I didn't understand it, but I accepted the date. I'd lived there for 10 years. It was autumn. Charlie would leave when we settled the divorce. I'd get my stuff out by early spring. Charlie filed for divorce on October 15th. The press picked up on it right away, since filings like that are a matter of public record. It was my turn to learn private news in a public forum. But to his credit, Charlie didn't talk to the press for a long time. He could have sold his side of the story, but he wasn't that kind of person. I respected that. In spite of his anger, Charlie emailed asking to have one last meeting face-to-face. He wanted closure. He said he wanted to say goodbye while he still remembered why he loved me. He wrote, "I know your fears. You're scared to be alone with me." He suggested a quiet restaurant. He was right. I was scared. Like a coward, I emailed him trying to change the date. He responded saying, "Actually, the more I think about this, the more it's clearly not a good idea." He canceled. One of my biggest regrets is not having that last meeting with Charlie. I owed him that. We had been so close for so long. I wish I'd been brave enough to say goodbye. As for the divorce settlement, well, remember how my mother threatened to call off the wedding if we didn't sign the prenup by the end of the day? Charlie and I joked at the time that he had signed it under duress. Now the prenup was coming into play far sooner than anyone had anticipated, and there was risk he'd contest it because of the time pressure we'd been under. My mother's efforts to protect me had backfired, and I was the one who had to pay the settlement, not her. Making such a big change was hard and messy, but Dean was worth it. And though it took me some time to realize, there was a transformation beyond finally being with the right person. I'd always been a mess of irrational fears. Every time I went to a movie theater, I thought I was going to be shot. When I walked down the street, I'd imagine that someone was following me. I was scared to sit with my back to a window in restaurants. Then there was airplane travel. When I flew, I had to bring along a slew of good luck items. The bag of crystals, the good luck teddy bears, a specific necklace. Yeah, you might call me a little OCD. Like how if I'm eating potatoes, I won't leave one potato alone on the plate. I'll cut it in half so it has a friend. If there are three beans left on my plate, I'll eat one so there are two and they can be friends. I know it's weird and crazy, but I feel sorry for the food. I don't like things to be alone. Now that I was with Dean, things were different. In the course of a single week, I had left my whole life behind. I met change head on. In the first 2 years together, we would live in six different places. It didn't matter. I was finally safe. Safe with Dean. A lot of the OCD stuff stopped when I met Dean. I used to get all kinds of free swag, so I always had a bunch of different shampoos and conditioners in my shower. When I got out, I'd have to make sure they were all facing out, because if they were facing the wrong way, I felt uneasy that they couldn't see. And they'd have to all be touching so they'd be equal. And I used to have to tap a toe of each foot in the shower before I got all the way in or out. I remember coming back to my apartment in LA after meeting Dean in Ottawa. The first time I took a shower, I went to straighten all the shampoo bottles, and then I stopped myself. This was crazy. I got out of the shower and never did it again. In spite of the shadows of my former life, I was so happy with Dean. I was finally living a smaller, more normal existence. It wasn't exactly the laundry room closet I'd craved, but my life was considerably simplified. I'd accumulated so much crap living in that condo for 10 years, so much that I didn't need. Here, I had nothing and wanted nothing. I was free. I was starting over with Dean. I was starting a whole new life. Is that a knife in your purse, or are you just glad to see me? For Christmas, Dean and I planned to go to Canada. I was going to meet his family in Collingwood, a little town 2 hours outside Toronto, where two of his three sisters live. We, along with Mimi and Ferris, our faithful companions, started the trip by spending a few days in Toronto, where I met all of Dean's friends. Then, on the afternoon of Christmas Eve, we drove up to Collingwood. On the way there, Dean said, "My sisters are so excited to meet you." They both worked at a ski resort in town, and he told me that they'd arranged for us to take a carriage ride through a Christmas tree farm. A carriage ride through a Christmas tree farm sounded idyllic. Now, why hadn't my father imported that winter wonderland to our backyard in LA? In Collingwood, there were a couple inches of snow coating the ground. We barely got our bags in the house when Dean packed a bottle of wine and a couple of glasses and hurried us off to the carriage ride. Apparently, in Canada, and possibly in all parts of the world where places exist that call themselves Christmas tree farms, the trees are actually in the ground. You pick the one you want, and they chop it down right in front of you. Note to self, never go to a Thanksgiving turkey farm. Our carriage was an open horse-drawn number, driven by an old man and woman who looked suspiciously like Santa and Mrs. Claus. I felt like I was at some amusement park, about to go on Jingle Bells, the ride. It was starting to rain, but they cheerfully bundled us up in the back seat and we set off. The path through the snow was dimly lit by hurricane candles and moonlight. The flickering candlelight reflecting off the snow gave everything an ethereal glow. All you could see were miles and miles of trees. As we drove, I started talking to the couple. I asked if they were married. They said they'd been married for 44 years. It was the cutest thing, this little old couple doing carriage rides together all winter long. I said to Dean, "I hope that's us." I was only 32 and Dean was 38. It wasn't unreasonable to hope that we still had at least 44 good years to spend together. Then the carriage came to a stop. The clauses said, "Okay, this is where we let you off." I was a little confused. Were we being held for ransom? But Dean said, "I think my sisters set something up for us." We walked through the grove and came to a little table in the middle of a clearing. It was surrounded with hurricane candles. There were two chairs and a bottle of Veuve Clicquot, my favorite champagne. All the surrounding trees were decorated with Christmas ornaments. We sat down at the table. Dean said, "Oh my God, my sisters really went overboard." I was thinking, does Dean have the best sisters in the entire world? Or is he going to ask me to marry him? And my next thought was, now? I'm freezing and soaked. I must look like a drowned rat. We opened the champagne and shared a toast. Then Dean dropped on one knee in the snow, pulled out a ring, and asked me to marry him. I started laughing and full-on bawling simultaneously. As I said yes, I could barely breathe. My heart was like a cartoon heart, beating so hard it was bursting out of my chest. I felt elated and overwhelmingly in love. It was the greatest moment ever. Then it hit me. Oh, this was what it was supposed to feel like the first time. Every time I had an experience with Dean that I'd been through with Charlie was a lesson in how it was supposed to feel. Maybe I should have known Charlie wasn't right, but only now could I look back and see a million stop signs that I had failed to recognize. I'd had nothing to compare it to. It was a beautiful, glorious, freezing, romantic moment. At some point, Dean shouted, "She said yes!" It echoed and echoed through the trees. Then, completely unexpectedly, there were fireworks. Neither Dean nor his amazing sisters could take credit for those. They were Christmas Eve fireworks from a nearby town, but we decided to take them personally. I was on top of the world, and nothing could interfere with that. But as always, all my silver moments have cloudy linings. My relationship with my mother had been cool since my wedding to Charlie. We never got in touch about the divorce. I missed her 60th birthday party. We weren't officially in a fight or not speaking, but we weren't exactly bosom buddies. And yet she was the only person I reached out to when Dean and I got engaged. I sat down and wrote my mother a long email. Dean was asleep. I'd taken an Ambien, so maybe my judgment wasn't perfect. But I poured out my heart in that email. I told her that I was so happy, so in love. I'd finally found real love, and I wanted to share it with her, to share it with my family. I wrote, "I want you to know and love Dean. I want us all to get together when we get home." In the back of my head somewhere, I suspected that she wouldn't want to hear that I was really happy and in love, because she wasn't happy. She didn't have that kind of love in her life. But I thought, she's my mother. She should want me to be happy. I want her to be a part of it. I had a slew of emails with congratulations in the subject line sitting in my inbox on AOL. But my mother's response didn't come for 4 days. Finally, a reply appeared. It was a brief email. It said, "Congratulations on your engagement. Daddy and I are very happy for you. Love, Mom." It went on to say, "P.S. We've decided to sell the condo sooner than anticipated, and we need you out of it by January 30th. That gives you 1 month." I laughed. Then I cried. Then I laughed again. Here it was, documented for history. This was our relationship. My mother was evicting me. That night over dinner with Dean's sisters and our new friends, someone suggested that I email my mother and ask for an extension. But I refused. I thought she wanted a reaction, and I wasn't going to give her the satisfaction. I didn't want to ask for anything from her again. I'd rather go way into debt. In fact, with the divorce and the hotels and the wild shopping compulsion I'd indulged before I met Dean, I already was in debt. Hiring movers to pack and store 10 years of my life in record time cost me $10,000. I think of that as my mother's engagement present to us. Not long after we came home from Canada, Dean and his soon-to-be ex-wife started having custody issues. The details, again, aren't my story to tell. But one subject that emerged in their conversations was Dean's dream that for the sake of the children, we'd all get along eventually. Probably in hope of moving the custody dispute along, his wife, Mary Jo, said she wanted to meet me. The way Dean presented it was that she wanted to talk to me about being a stepmom. This was 100 times worse than facing Charlie. I mean, put all my non-confrontational past aside, and you've still got me sitting face to face with a woman whose husband of 12 years and father of her children left her for me 4 months ago. She had every right to be angry at me. And for her, wouldn't it be a simple, logical jump from, this woman destroyed my marriage, to, and so I must destroy her? These things happen, especially in TV movies. I'd probably starred in this one. His ex-wife would murder me, and all the papers would say was, TV movie queen Tori Spelling murdered again, this time for real. My producers at So Notorious said, what? No, he's not seeing straight. You can't go see this woman. Nothing good can come out of it. If you do go, Dean should go with you. But Dean said, no, she wants to meet with you alone. Of course she wanted me to come alone. She wanted to kill me. Finally, he told me it was something I should do for his son. So I agreed. I figured, worst case scenario, I die. And then Dean would feel bad. But I was going to be brave. If I survived, it would be the bravest thing I'd ever done. I was the other woman. I didn't want to be threatening. So I dressed in jeans, a baggy sweater, and tennis shoes. I didn't wear makeup. I put my hair in pigtails, possibly a mistake since she's 12 years older than I am. Oh, and one more thing. At the last minute before I walked out the door, I turned around and grabbed the biggest kitchen knife out of the knife block. I stuffed it into my purse. Mary Jo welcomed me into her house with a gracious smile. She was pretty and pleasant. As we sat down to talk, I made two potentially fatal mistakes right off the bat. One, out of habit, I deposited my purse on the dining room table. Now we were in the living room. I was completely defenseless. And two, she brought me tea I hadn't seen her make. And I drank it. Had I learned nothing from my TV movies? But as the minutes passed and my vision didn't go all blurry, I finally relaxed a little. We sat there for 3 hours. Conversation didn't exactly flow. She made limited eye contact. Even so, she set a sort of old girlfriend chit-chat vibe, as if we'd gone to school together and hadn't seen each other for 5 or 6 years. She led the conversation, kind of giving me tips on Dean in a confiding but somewhat ominous way, saying things like, oh, he has the worst temper, but you'll see that eventually. I kept trying to steer the conversation toward my responsibilities as a stepmom, but she had other things on her mind. We left on a nice note. She thanked me. We even hugged. Two main feelings swirled in my head. The first was pride. For once in my life, I had tackled my fear head on. It haunted me that I'd never had that final meeting with Charlie. It still keeps me up at night. But this time, I'd actually done it. The second feeling I had was doubt. I was going home to Dean, and somehow she'd put questions in my head. I loved him. I knew that. But how well did I know him? Dean was floored when I told him. I can't believe I sent you into a meeting where you'd come back doubting our relationship. But the doubts were short-lived. And no matter how stupid Dean felt, I didn't regret that meeting one bit. It was the bravest thing I'd ever done, even if I had to do it with a Balenciaga sheathed knife in hand. What? It doesn't grow on trees? Blood, sweat, tears, and hair extension maintenance. I worked around the clock on So Notorious. Sometimes I'd come to the set to start filming at 5 or 6 in the morning. I'd wrap at 8 at night and head to the writer's trailer to brainstorm new episodes until midnight. Then the next morning, I'd be back on set. It was my total career fantasy finally come true. Being in the writer's room felt like therapy. I'd sit there recounting stories, and the other writers would chime in with their own stories or ideas about how to make mine funnier. It felt good to get all that stuff out and to laugh about it. Playing myself on the show was scary at first. Usually, I have a character to build around. But when that character was me, was I just supposed to say everything the way I'd say it? Or was I supposed to act like me? Of course, Just because it was loosely based in my life didn't mean that the character was exactly me. I'm a little more grounded. It was more like me in my younger 90210 days, even though the show was supposed to be taking place post-90210. Then there was the executive producer side of the job. I was in charge on set. That had never happened before. There were moments when I stepped back and realized we were working on a set that was supposed to be my apartment. The characters were supposed to be my friends. The story was supposed to be my life. I was literally reliving some of the most memorable moments from my past, but this time I was mic'd and there was better lighting. It was all because of an idea I had. I made this happen, and I loved every second of it. Lonnie Anderson played my mother, and she eventually became like a cool mother figure to me. So much so that at some point she said, "I'm sad for your mother. She has no idea what an amazing daughter she has. She doesn't even know you. It's her loss." Before the show even aired, we started getting reviews. They were the best I'd ever gotten. The LA Times ran a feature saying, "Beverly Hills 90210 alumna, tabloid regular, gay icon, and plucky Hollywood heiress, Tori Spelling, has her fans. But in the 16 years she's been working as an actress, the 32-year-old has been subjected to what even the most poisonous observer of pop culture would have to admit is more than her fair share of vitriol and ridicule." They went on to say, "While this sort of thing has been done before, it has been done here exceedingly well. She is a comedian, not a starlet, and if she is made for no other comedies than this one, she has landed for now in the exact right place. Little Tori, happy at last." The show hadn't aired, and the producers were already taking the reviews to the frame shop. I should have known it was the kiss of death. The night So Notorious premiered, Dean and I had a little party at our house for the cast, producers, and our agents. The ratings were, at best, mediocre. Our premiere fell on the evening that daylight saving time kicked in, so there was hope that the time change had caused a mix-up, but the next week it was the same thing. Blah ratings. At first, VH1 said not to worry, so we all hoped the ratings would pick up in the second season. Some shows are like that. The show was a critical success. It was a good, smart show. We felt blindsided when VH1 changed their tune and didn't give us a second season. The reason they gave for canceling the show was that it was too expensive. It cost $1 million to make a single episode, and they could spend $200,000 per episode on a reality show and get better ratings. They said, "Maybe we're just not ready for scripted TV." We met with the head of VH1 and offered to cut the budget in half. I said I'd take half my salary. He said, "I guess I'm going to lose my standing in the gay community if I cancel." The show had a cultish following, particularly among gay men, but then he canceled it anyway. VH1 went silent. All the people we'd been friends with there disappeared. It was like a breakup. We never heard from them again. I was 33 years old at the time. I'd been working almost consistently since high school, and I had nothing to show for it. All actors know that you need to strike when the iron's hot. You never turn down work. So I worked all through my 20s and sacrificed love, friends, relaxation, a college education. Now, after all that, I was $200,000 in debt, almost bankrupt. And how did a girl like me end up in debt? Well, I guess it starts with how I grew up. You remember the birthday parties. My godfather, Dean Martin, would give me a money tree blossoming with $20 bills. And where would that money go after everyone oohed and awed? I have no idea. Even when I was 16 years old and working full-time on 90210, my financial independence took the form of a credit card. The bill went straight to my business manager. I didn't give a second thought to how much something cost and had absolutely no idea what my bill was every month. I came from money, but I didn't exactly expect to be supported, now or in the future. I'd been living independently since I moved out of the manor, except that I paid rent to my mother for the 10 years before she evicted me. I hadn't even gotten a money tree from Dean Martin since the mid-80s. Before my father got sick, before I sold So Notorious, I had lunch with my dad at his office once a week or every couple weeks. Eventually, people who were pretty high up at his office started telling me that he was starting to fade. He was a little out of it, and they said in no uncertain terms that they thought I should talk to him about the contents of his will before he was any further gone. It felt gross and wrong, but my father's colleagues were emphatic enough that I eventually summoned the nerve to broach the subject with my father. At one of our lunches, I said, "I hate to bring this up, Dad, but I know you love me and Randy, and I know you'd want to protect us and your future grandchildren. I'm not asking for anything, but I just want to make sure you know what your will says about me and Randy." I said, "I don't want to get into details, but I want you to make sure that everything's set up the way that you want it to be." He said, "Let me find out. I'll talk to my business manager." I didn't have to ask again. The next time we had lunch, he said, "Babe, I talked to the business manager about the will. You and Randy are going to be fine. You guys are totally set up. Don't worry. You're getting just under $1 million. You'll be fine." And he believed it. I have no idea what the actual number is, but reports had it that my father was worth $500 million. I realized in that moment that my father knew nothing about money. Of course I know $1 million is a lot of money. But was it in my family? My father would buy my mother a $1 million necklace for Mother's Day without blinking. At the same time, I believe he was totally sincere when he thought I was beyond set for life. I thought, "God, okay, it is what it is." In that same conversation, my father said, "I know you need money right now, and I want to help you out. If I give you something today, will you promise me to just accept it?" I thought he was going to write me a check. He didn't know the extent of my debt, but anything would help. Instead, he went with Aunt Renee, his assistant of 40 years, to his safe. When he came back, he handed me 5 $100 bills, saying ceremoniously, "This should help you out for a while." I shouldn't have been surprised. Often when I saw him, he'd slip me a $20 bill and say, "Don't tell your mother." This was my dad at a restaurant. Eat the meal, add the tip to the check, hand the struggling actor waiter $100. And then there was me. He never said a single word about wanting us to make it on our own. He never did anything to teach us about the value of money. He never talked about wanting us to be independent. But there you have it. Just because someone has a lot of money doesn't mean they spend much time thinking about it. So, getting back to the question at hand, how did I find myself in debt? What about all those years on 90210? All those TV movies? Where was my nest egg? I guess the best answer is that I didn't think about it. I wasn't raised to think about money. I had no idea how to manage it or how to put myself on a budget. I was born into a millionaire lifestyle, and I had no idea how to live any other way. If my mother liked a shirt and a catalog, she'd order it in 6 colors. I went from that way of living with my parents to working on 90210, where for a while I was able to maintain it without their help. I didn't live in a mansion, but if I walked into Barney's and saw a cashmere sweater I liked, I'd take it in multiple colors, just like I'd learned from my mom. I never looked at the price tag. Moran always calls those the glory days. He says, we'd walk into Dolce & Gabbana. They'd see you, close down the store, and bring out the champagne. You drop $50,000. We were on top of the world. As recently as right before I met Dean, my shopping was at an all-time high. I was obsessed with internet shopping. I didn't want to be in the living room with Charlie, and I didn't have work, so I'd disappear into my office and shop online for hours. I was on eBay constantly. Not a day went by when boxes didn't arrive at the door. I wouldn't even open them. The boxes would just pile up in the dining room. Now things were different. Years had gone by where I still bought whatever I wanted to buy. I lived the high life, but my income was unstable and fluctuating. I wasn't making millions. Dean and I hit reality. We had to start thinking about our budget. I'm a fashion whore, and I love clothing, but I had to change where I shopped. I became the girl who looks for the bargain. My friend Jenny buys a lot of her clothes at a fancy boutique called Calypso. She'll spend $400 on a sundress. I used to spend that without blinking. Now I'll spend $25 at Forever 21 and be just as satisfied. Once you change, I think you change forever. I don't think I could ever go back to spending money so easily. That's not to say that I don't still indulge, but I'll buy a good piece that I know will last me for years to come. And I still have a serious weakness for Christian Louboutin shoes. But you can wear shoes over and over again. Right, that's another thing. I get photographed a lot. One year I was on the cover of Us Weekly 4 times. Even if the reasons why are different, sometimes it seems I'm photographed by the media as often as big stars like Jennifer Aniston and Angelina Jolie. But stars like that don't have to pay for most of their clothes, especially red carpet dresses. I go out, I'm photographed in a dress, and, unless I want to be mocked by the press, which maybe someday I'll be brave enough to invite upon myself, but don't I get mocked enough already? I can't wear it again. Look, I'm not complaining. I'm just trying to explain what it feels like to think about money for the first time in your 30s. Adjusting my lifestyle has been, for the most part, a good learning experience. The day I met Dean, my whole world changed for the better. I could go with the flow. Love made all the other stuff unimportant. A new family. When it came time to plan my wedding to Dean, I contacted the only travel agent I knew, the one who arranged my honeymoon with Charlie. It was kind of an awkward email to send. Hi, a year ago I asked you to plan my honeymoon, and now I'm asking you to find a place for my next wedding. But business is business. She didn't complain. Dean and I fell in love alone. We'd both had big weddings the first time around. Now we wanted to get married alone. We told the travel agent that we wanted to be married on a tropical beach. We wanted privacy. It should be secluded and spiritual. Other than that, we were open to anything. A couple days went by, and then a packet from the travel agent arrived in the mail. I opened it with excitement, ready to explore our options. But there was only one slim brochure inside. It was for a place called the Wakaya Club in Fiji. Shouldn't there be options? Our travel agent was telling us, I can send you other brochures, but this is the place. She was so firm. And how could it be the wrong place when I was with the right man? We decided to take a leap of faith. We booked it. 2 weddings in 2 years, and the only thing they had in common was me. For the second wedding, I didn't want a classic wedding dress. We were getting married on the beach. In Dolce & Gabbana, I found a fitted white eyelet summer dress. It wasn't a wedding dress, but it had a short train. It was perfect. It was a 10-hour flight to Fiji. As I've mentioned, I inherited my fear of flying from my father, who came by it honestly. He served in the U.S. Air Force and was on his way from Fort Worth, Texas, to an air base in Ohio when he came down with the flu. The flight surgeon pulled him off the plane. He was too sick to fly. That plane to Ohio crashed, and everyone on it was killed. My father rented a car and drove straight from Fort Worth to Dallas to see his parents. But when he entered his childhood home, his mother opened the door and immediately fainted. The authorities had telephoned to tell the family that my father was dead. When she came to, she made him swear he'd never fly again. He promised. He was 18, and he never got on an airplane again. Growing up, every time I traveled by plane, he'd cry, and I'd cry. You wonder why planes give me migraines? Someone from the Wakanda